Okay, we're here. We'll get started. I just want to say that today's share is once again sponsored by Jake and Tamar Burek from Montreal with friends in honor, in memory of Eileen and Dr. Jack Rothstein and B and Arthur Tenenbaum, and in honor of the children, Debbie and Mark Tenenbaum. So, Louis Nishmatam, and in honor of the children. I went to school with Mark also.
And you have it.
Yeah, I don't.
Okay. Everybody, so thank you all, and again, thank you for your forbearance. So what we're going to do today is, after last time's lengthy introduction, actually start learning some text from Rav Kook on the subject at hand, on the Teshuvah. Before we do, I just wanted to do a very little bit of show and tell, just because I mentioned the different sorts of publications of Rav Kook's. And just so for further explorations, when you're standing in a bookstore, you'll be, find it a little easier to orient yourselves. As I said, most of, his theological writings that we know come from his journals that he wrote and that were edited by others. In addition to, like, as many as other works, his topic works and so on. So the standard edition of his works are the ones published by Mossad Harav Kook, and they tend to look like this, right? So maybe familiar. They have these very distinctive white bindings, and sort of very nicely designed. The Nazir himself was central to the design of it. Then those, they were sort of half jokingly always Hashas Halavan, the white Shas. These are the books published by Mossad Harav Kook. They are the standard edition of Rav Kook's works. Almost all of them were edited by Rav Tzvi Yehuda, including Orot HaTshuvah, which we'll be talking about. It's, the rather central that we're talking about in our Shiurim, except for these volumes entitled Orot HaKodesh that were edited by Rav David Kohen HaNazir. Now, as I said, his notebooks have been getting published in recent years in their original form through two different publication enterprises in two different series. In one, they are referred to as Kvatzin, and these books tend to look, I'll get into English translation in a moment, and they tend to look like this, or like this, right? These are edited by, these are manuscripts of Cook's various descendants, and are edited by Rav Boaz Ofen. Then you have this other set that are referred to as Pinkasim, right? You notice they look a little more like classical Sfarim, And they are edited by circles closer to Yeshivat Merkaz Harav Kook. So the difference between these two sets of series is that, frankly, these are published in more or less the original form, and these are heavily edited and at times to the point of censorship. What crosses the line between editorial work and censorship? When somebody tells you, I am presenting something more or less as it is, but I've cut out a bunch of things, but I don't need to tell you what those are, right? As opposed to sort of like Rav Tzvi Yehuda or the Nazir tell you, I have edited this, right? However, in this series, they have access to some manuscripts. This one will have access to other manuscripts. So you kind of need both. Interestingly, sometimes volumes will be published out of this series or other books published in their uncensored form, and then they'll be published in this series in their censored form, sort of to establish this is the canonical series, okay? This is the one you should be looking at from the perspective of those editors. But like I said, you really, really need to be looking at both. Have they been translated into English? Not in their original form, but a number of things are, most of the I'll be sending out at the end of our series, a document I prepared with suggestions for further reading. All sorts of passages from these, to the extent to which they themselves into other works like Rota Chuvah and Rota Kodesh and so forth, have been published in English in all sorts of ways. The journals themselves, no. I mean, I know a very serious scholar who was thinking of devoting the remaining decades of his career to translating Rav Kook's journals because it would take that long. I don't know if he's doing that as such, but there's ample resources in English. So now to the texts themselves. If I may, Rabbi Kelman, can I screen share? Okay, great. Let me, here, I will share screen. And here we are. Great. Okay. So, and now will you recall what we said last week? Last week we sort of did a brief run through of, just to sort of as a bit of a reminder, right? Last week we did a brief run through of sort of basic ideas of how tshuva is thought of in the Kabbalah and the Jewish mystical tradition. And as we said, crucially, that we're in the framework of the Sefirot, sort of like the lattice work of divine energies that constitute the deep structure of being and world, teshuvah is identified with this one, binah, and that you see it's rather high up in the structure here, and such teshuvah in the Kabbalah is thought of as a return to one's source, a return to one's fountain origin, a return, so to speak, to the womb, right? And also, interestingly, it is associated with kind of freedom, right? The same way in the Jubilee cycle, right? Sort of, you know, there's, I bet something I should have mentioned last week. Like some of you may be familiar. Like you notice in Sefirat HaOmer, right? Sort of there's these when we count the Omer in our Arvit, sort of at the end, there's this tefillah that you're supposed to say, and you say that, you know, and may this be a tikkun for what you did in Chesed Shibura, Gura Shibachesed Tiferet Shibahod Hod Shibanetzach, right? So I'm using that as a sidur. So what that is it's working through the seven lower sefirot. The idea is that, you know, Matan Torah and Shavuot, and that Yitzhak Mitzrayim is Chesed, right? And we proceed through seven cycles of seven, right? A week in Chesed, a week in Gura, a week in Tiferet, a week in Netzach, a week in Rishisa, a week in Malchut, which is Torah Shabbat. Okay, and the descent of the Shekhinah to the world, on Har Sinai, on Shavuot, right? So you see that these things also work liturgically as well as theologically, right? So there's this cluster of ideas that tshuva is about a return to one's source. It's a return to the fount of one's being. It's also kind of setting, going free, right? And we saw these ideas developed in the Kabbalah. We saw how they also emerge, right, sort of in Chassidut. And also we talked a little bit about the Kabbalah of the Ramchal, right, and Rabbi Moshe Chaim Sato, for whom tikkun, right, the great process of healing and restoration, which the Kabbalah understood as like the healing and restoration, so to speak, of the shattered structure of divinity of this world, doesn't take place only in the mind and only in the realm of the spirit, but also is a process that happens through history. And that it has a kind of structure through history. And we're going to see Rav Kook takes all these ideas and synthesizes them. Now, first we're going to start with something Rav Kook wrote in the 1890s, years before he gets to Eretz Yisrael. Rav Kook comes on Aliyah, because remember, crucially, you know, like all thinkers, and Rav Kook is very, the issue is squarely on the table, he is both interpreting all the traditions that he's received and understanding them in the light of his historical moment. Now, Rav Kook comes on Aliyah in 1904. Interestingly, until he comes on Aliyah, Zionism and that sort of thing is really not much on his screen. His first essays about Jewish nationalism start appearing only in 1901. And in them, he's not necessarily talking about Zionism. Indeed, there's writings of his from his Eastern European period when he's willing to entertain, you know, the Uganda project, or at least, you know, even rhetorically, just like it's not, you know, the Uganda proposal is maybe not, you know, people who support Uganda, well, that's okay too, right? That's a nice thing too. But even if he's not interested in Zionism, he's always interested in the world around him. And in the 1890s, one of the things that's very much preoccupying him is a controversy which not many people remember today, but at the time it was a very big deal, which was the Musar controversies of the 1890s, right? We've heard of the Musar movement, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And by the 1890s, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter has been dead for some while. By the way, parenthetically, people have been talking about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter lately with regard to corona, because famously in the 1860s, a cholera epidemic, when doctors advised that it was not a good idea to fast during the cholera epidemic, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter famously ate on Yom Kippur in front of his congregation, just to make the point. And then some people have been sort of talking about that historical precedent nowadays in terms of thinking out, like, you know, what corners will we, not necessarily eat on Yom Kippur nowadays, but, you know, what you can allow yourself on, you know, can you cut down the number of tkiot or number of whatever, you know. Anyway, so by the 1890s, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter has been in his heavenly reward for some while, but his disciples and their disciples are starting to spread the idea of Musar teaching in the world of the yeshivot, great yeshivot Torah studies centers of Lithuania. And it's very controversial studying Musar. Some people think it's a bitul Torah. Some people think, and there's some people who think this is great because like Musar very much appeals as a kind of vehicle of the spiritual life and moral introspection that you can do without being a chassid, right? Sort of if you think about the spiritual options available to people in Eastern Europe, and if chassidut for any number of reasons is not for you, you're a litvak, you don't believe in rebbes, you're sort of a disciple of the Gaon of Vilna, but you want something more, right? So Musar is appealing that way. Also, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter genuinely felt like, you know, that generally taught that that study without working on one's moral character is hollow, right? And he also thought that this was how to fortify Judaism against the onslaughts of modernity, for people to strengthen their moral character and their interpersonal ethics and become more introspective and all of that. And so there were some people who thought this was a bitul Torah, some people who didn't really like it, the way Musar at times was studied when was in these Musar sessions that were very ecstatic and where people would like pound their fists, pound their foreheads on the table and scream about themselves and so on. People thought this is not how the Torah should be acting. And Sir Yisrael Salanter himself wouldn't have wanted them to do that. And there were students who, yeshiva students who really because they're, you know, their Rosh Yeshiva would get into the idea of Musar, and this is a great thing. And they were like, no, well, I don't want this in my life. I don't, you know, and especially there were yeshivot that would install mashgichim ruchaniim, and students would rebel. I don't want something, you know, I came here to learn Torah, not to have some like guy, you know, checking my tzitzis all the time or slapping me around, but I'm not chuckling while I'm davening, etc. And there were huge fights and arguments about this.
Doctor, a couple people have mentioned kind of like that. So your sound occasionally fades in and out. So maybe speak closer to the microphone the whole time.
Okay, sure. I'll try to do that. So in his notebooks, Rav Kook, and this is something that he's going to do again and again, he sees both sides to the argument. He understands why people want a vehicle of Musar, a vehicle of something to make their learning more spiritually relevant and more ethically challenging. He understands why people have problems with like sort of the way Musar is going. And he sort of tries to take the best of both, right? We need to sort of take these impulses for spiritual and moral growth and development, not necessarily go in the direction of like the formal Musar movement, and think about how to turn this into learning. And because he's learning a lot of the Kabbalah of the Ramchal, how does the individual life figure here? Because another crucial thing that Rav Kook experienced in these years is that he studied a lot of Agadah, you know, which may not sound like a very big deal until you realize, like, Litvish Talmidei Chachamim in those years don't study Agadah, right? You know, the non-halachic portions of the Talmud are things you skip, or they are things you teach women and children, and that's not meant in the nicest way, right? And in his journals, he regularly writes about his own desire to spend time studying Agadah and to studying Machshavat Yisrael and study all these things that Lithuanian yeshiva culture doesn't exactly celebrate, but that he feels he really needs to do. And in this introspection, he comes to conclude that the individual's inner religious life is something that God has given you in order to do your part in the great tikkun of the world. So here we have something that he writes. This book, Musar Avicha, is something that his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, put together in the 1940s based on Rav Kook's notebooks from around the time of the Musar controversy in the 1890s, right? Sort of the title, Musar Avicha, is a clever pun, like Musar of your father, right? Also like the opening lines of the book of Proverbs, Shna B'ni Musar Avicha, Val Tita Shtorari Mecha. Avicha is also, of course, the acronym for Avram Yitzchak HaKohen. And in the course of, and for Tzvi Yehuda, of course, this is his father, right? So here's one passage from there. I'll read it in Hebrew and then in English. Yesod tikkun avodah hu l'sader kol davar v'chol koach bein b'nefesh u'vein ba'olam v'yosher al mechono. Lo la'apech limnoa b'zeh hashpa'at Elohim masad ha'adam ba'olam yashar. Right. And in English, the foundation of tikkun, the repair and restoration of the world, is to organize everything and every power, be it in the soul or the world, justly in its place, and not to reverse order and thus present the flow, the effluence of forces of energies. God made man in the world straight. God made Elohim asad Adam be'olam yashar, right? The pasuk in Kohelet that we'll read in a few weeks is Elohim asad Adam yashar. God made man straight, Rav Kook sort of in the flow of his thought adds the words be'olam, right? With the plenitude of powers or energies, so to speak, and means necessary for perfection or wholeness, shleimut of body and soul, to do good and to intellect, like to think. And one who undoes the order derived from his governance ravages and destroys. This is an idea Rav Kook is going to develop again and again over the years. And it's in some respects, it's like a great cosmic version of what, you know, what my mother told me when she wanted me to clean up my room when I was a boy, right? A place for everything and everything in its place. God made the world. God made the whole world, which also means God didn't just make you and me. He made my inner life and your inner life. And God made our souls in such a way that they are meant to contribute to the greater good. Me in my way, you in your way. Interestingly, this verse from Kohelet, Elohim asad Adam yashar, in Rav Kook's, in these years, the 1890s, this is the pasuk Rav Kook quotes more than any other. It shows up time and again and again and again and again, because there's here a fundamental affirmation of the world, a fundamental affirmation of the goodness of the world and the goodness of the human person, right? And so he's saying that my inner life is part of a process that's bigger than myself. I have to be true to that and be true to this process. And remember, tshuva for the Kabbalah isn't just something we do. It's a force in the world. It's the force in the world that wants to bring us home. So now here's something from something else that Rav Kook writes in those years. As I said, he loved studying the Agadah, and he even wrote a commentary on the Agadot of Masechtot, Brachot, and Shabbat called Einaya. Einaya, the falcon's eye, is a verse in the book of Job, Sefer Yob. And also, this is a pun on his name. Einaya, Aya, it also is, you know, Avram Yitzchak HaKohen, sort of the eye of Avram Yitzchak HaKohen, and also punning on the name Ein Yaakov, which is, of course, the great 16th century anthology of Agadot, of Talmudic Agadot. And so in Einaya, very much, I mean, this is something I argue. Some other scholars of Rav Kook think I'm not necessarily right about this, but I do think I'm onto something here. I think that Einaya very much is for him a study text for Musar, right? He wants to take the positive energies of the Musar movement, but rather than, you know, turning it into, but actually to make it an exercise of the mind, right? Not to sort of like take one passage in Masilat Yesharim and read it over and over again, but rather to take the medieval Jewish philosophical tradition, of which Maimonides, the Rambam, is the most best known exponent, but not by no means the only one, where central to the religious life is the cultivation of the self and the cultivation of the soul and the cultivation of the mind. And he tries to sort of take the Talmudic Agadot and make that a vehicle for that sort of cultivation of the mind and the self. And he does this through the volumes of Einaya. And here's just like, it's actually a wonderful book to read. It's in four volumes. So here's just like one snippet taken from Einaya to Tractate Brachot. Tachlit ha'mtziut hi kidei shetetze, it should, instead of erapol, it should say elapoal. Kishetetze elapoal habchira tova shel asiyat hatova chokma bechovish gamur mirtzon v'chepetz pini. Right? The purpose of existence, the end of existence, the goal of existence is what? To actualize the good choice of doing good and acting wisely in utter freedom from an inner will and desire. Right? What's a truly good world? A truly good world is a world where I want to do the good, you want to do the good. We all want to do the good. And ideally, in Ruach's later writings, is going to develop this at great length, you know, sort of at the ideal world is one in which, you know, we do the good as naturally as we breathe. Where I don't have to neurotically choose between competing desires all the time. I want to do good. I want to do evil. I want to do good. I want to do evil. Okay, I'll do good. I mean, that's nice. But wouldn't it be nicer if you yourself were a vessel of the good? Right? Sometimes I think some of you may have probably heard stories about the great Jerusalem tzaddik, Rabbi Arye Levin, right? You may have seen the book by Simcha Raz, a tzaddik in our time, that this wonderful, really remarkably saintly man, Rabbi Arye Levin, he was spent his life ministering to the sick, to the poor. He was the rabbi to the prisoners for decades on end. And he was very close with Rav Kook. And Rav Kook, one thing he used to say about him was that Rav Arye was like gomel chesed begufo. In his very body, he was doing chesed. His very bodily presence was doing chesed, right? And that's something I think the Rav Kook was kind of aiming at here. I mean, you're saying that, So the religious life, and again, because this is what tshuva is going to aim to do, to celebrate the actualization of one's desire to do good. And notice this word, b'chofesh gamur, with utter freedom. And again, we said in the Kabbalah, and if I'm aware of this, he's certainly aware of this. Right? Chofesh in the Kabbalah is synonymous with tshuva. Sort of to really return, to repent, is to liberate one's own self, and so to speak, achieve one's freedom. Somebody asked last week, positive, negative freedom, we'll be talking about that, right? We'll be talking about that more. And here's a further elaboration. So he takes, and this is Pinchas Acharon Beboisk. This is, Boisk was the town where he was a rabbi. He was rabbi in a shtetl for a number of years called Zaymel, and then he was rabbi in a much bigger place called Boisk, and and from there he went to Namiya. And in one of his notebooks, on which his son Tzviyuda wrote across the title page, Pinchas Acharon Beboisk, this is the last notebook of Beboisk, we find the following. He quotes the Gemara in Masechet Pesachim, right? Hatshuva kadma leolam, mimnei shachayim shlemi, right? Because there's a line in Masechet Pesachim that tshuva, so that God, tshuva is one of the things that God created before God created the world. What does that mean, right? You know, like if there's no people and no people who are messing up, why should you need to create this thing before you create the world? Tshuva kadma leolam, mimnei shachayim ashlimim hem dafk al pi ha-teva. Ve-ha-teva hino ba'al istaklut, al ken ha-chet muchrach, ein adam tzadik ba'aretz asher yaseh tov v'lo yachta. Right, he sort of mixes up the pasuk a little bit, because he's writing freely in this one. Vatshuvam takenera kilkul. Elo shiye adam bil tichote, mimnei shivatel ha-chayim b'tiba'am, zeo atzmo ha-chedi yoter gadol. V'chiper alav miasher chatal ha-nefesh, al ken yesod olam hi ha-tshuva olam ha-chirut, shal shem kach, mechanim shem Hashem, Elohim chayim. In English. Repentance preceded the world. Why? Because perfected life occurs specifically in nature, right? In Rav Kook, you find a fundamental affirmation. Again, Elohim asad adam yashar, and he says, Elohim asad adam be'olam yashar. You find a fundamental affirmation of the world as it exists and of human beings as they exist, right? Nature. And again, for Rav Kook, you know, in general, the word nature, you know, we often use the word nature to mean like, you know, the trees and the birds and the flowers and so forth. But when he says nature, he doesn't just mean inanimate life the way we often do nowadays. Nature is a synonym for being things being what they most truly are. That's why we attach the word nature to the sky and the sea and the birds and the flowers, because they utterly are what they are, right? You know, the sky isn't thinking about what kind of sky it is. The birds aren't flying around asking themselves if they're the kinds of birds their grandmothers want them to be. They just are what they are. The natural world is what it is. And God is in the natural world too, right? And the world that God created, the world in which God's perfection happens, is the natural world, right? Throughout Rav Kook, like, you know, ideally Torah is not at war with the natural world. I mean, I don't know if we're going to get into it here, but later on, he develops this idea of Torah Eretz Yisrael. The idea of Eretz Yisrael is that, yeah, in the Gola, maybe you need religion. That's at war with nature, but not in Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is the fusion of body and soul, right? And so sin is necessary because there's no mortal who does not sin. You know, there's an element of falling away from perfection will be inherent in the natural world. The natural world is not infinite. The natural world is limited. The natural world is subject to death and everything that death does to people. And repentance repairs the damage. But that a man be free of sin because he has undone natural life to say, okay, I'm not going to have anything to do with the world. I'm just going to be as kind of a monk or an ascetic. No. And then he quotes, there's the pasuk, right? B'chiper alav mesher chatal nefesh. And as some of you may recall, right, that verse in Sefer Bamidbar, in the Book of Numbers, is cited by the rabbis to explain why a Nazirite, when he finishes the period of the abstinence that the Nazir has taken upon himself, he has to bring a sin offering. Korban Chatan, why does he have to bring a sin offering? Why does he have to bring a sin offering? Because I'll say because he shouldn't have. You know, the Torah tells you how to live in the world. And this guy said that this world isn't good enough for me. Right? He sort of he denied himself the good things in this world. Right? So the foundation of the world, Cook says, is repentance, the world of freedom, for whose sake God's name is called life. It's because what is freedom? Then freedom is the actualization of the good in yourself and the good in the world and the realization, which is the realization of God's purpose in the world. And now I'd like to read this. Sort of another passage here. So this also appears in Orot HaTshuvah, which was Orot HaTshuvah is a volume of his teachings on Tshuvah that was first published in the 1920s, and edited by his son Rav Tzvi Yehuda. And some of the passages from the first three chapters of Orot HaTshuvah, which we may look at next time, were written as a set piece. Rav Kook wanted to write a treatise on Tshuvah. He writes these three chapters. You know, he was not great at writing systematically, so he sort of like gave up after these three chapters. And his son, Tzvi Yehuda, then compiled the rest from his notebooks. And Tzvi Yehuda, some of them we know were they in the notebooks. Others, Tzvi Yehuda just said, this is from before World War I, this is after World War I. So we just know this is from before World War I again, after he's been in Eretz Yisrael for several years. Now, once Rav Kook comes to Eretz Yisrael, he starts thinking a lot more about, I mean, he was already thinking about the Jewish peoplehood and the nation, but now he's thinking much more about the Jewish people. And he's thinking about the historical forces that are driving the Jewish people back to their land, right? And here we start seeing something else. Rav Kook is very concerned from the beginning with the rebellions against tradition in his time, right? You know, the world of 19th century Jewry in general, certainly, especially among Ashkenazi, among European Jews, Westerners, right, is a time of the collapse of tradition, right? Collapse of traditional communities, traditional Jewish life. You know, as Achad Ha'am famously put in a very important essay in 1897, the problem of the Jews and the problem of Judaism, right? The problem of the Jews is a sort of thing that Theodor Herzl is concerned about, right? You know, the problems of anti-Semitism, Jewish poverty, and that sort of thing. And the problem of Judaism is that the bottom has fallen out of Jewish life and Jewish commitment and so forth. You know, and Achad Ha'am argues that that's actually the more pressing problem in some ways than the problem of Jews, because the problem of the Jews, in Achad Ha'am, he puts it, you know, characteristic literary verb, you know, the problem of the Jews only happens in countries where there's like organized anti-Semitism and so forth. The problem of Judaism happens anytime a yeshiva boy gets his hands on a copy of Spinoza, right? You know, and sort of the tradition sort of dissolves in his hand. Now, crucial to Rav Kook's outlook, and one area where he differs greatly from his peers, is in his assessing the idealism that is driving, the idealistic motives that are driving many of the rebels against tradition. We talked about this a bit last time, right? You know, that as far as you know, that he sees that a lot of the people who are rejecting Jewish tradition, including former classmates of his from Yeshiva, are not doing it because they're looking for easy lives. They're doing it because they're genuinely committed to all kinds of values, right, that are unmistakably good. You know, protecting the Jewish people from their enemies, taking care of the poor, achieving social justice, etc. And what's interesting is that Rav Kook, rather than, so that's like one sort of observation. Okay, you know, their hearts are in the right place. But he takes it more deeply than that. And he argues that God works in the world through people's idealism. Anytime somebody wants to make the world better, somebody genuinely wants to make the world more just, more true, more beautiful, more fair, that's a yearning for God. That's what God is, right? God is not religion locked in a closet and you take it out three times a day or, and then like take it out in a big way on Shabbos, right? God is present in the workings of human society and culture when they're trying to do their best, right? Sort of in theology language, people call this a theology of culture. And Rav Kook relates this to the idea of tshuva. Hatshuva kolit shehi ilui haolam v'tikuno v'hatshuva pratit anugat liyishiyut pratit shel kol echad v'echad ad kedei dakut pratim shel tikunei hatshuva hamiyuchadim sheruach hakodesh yodea lefartam lefratim hayoter bodedim hein biyachad tochen echad v'chein kol otam tikunei hatarbut shal yadam העולם יוצא מחורבנו, סדרי החיים החברתיים והכלכליים, הולכים ומשתכללים עם תיקוני כל חטא ועוון, מחמורים שבחמורים עד דקדוקי סופרים ומידות חסידות יותר מופלגות, כולם הם חטיבה אחת ואינם נותקים זה מזה, וכולו לחד אתר סליקים. In English. The broad collective תשובה, which is the elevation and repair of the world, and the particular, and the individual, sort of the particular and individual tshuva, right? The tshuva that we're trying to do nowadays, Chodesh Elul, and the tshuva that somehow the collective does as a whole, which touches on the specific personality of each and every one, down to the minute details of the specifics of the repairs of tshuva, which the Holy Spirit knows to designate to the most distinct details, are all together of one piece. Okay. The tshuva of the world and the tshuva that you and I do in our daily life are connected. This is also something Rav Kook is not alone in this, right? As he says elsewhere, right, you know, our pnimiyut is part of the world. You know, we have the sense that I, as a human being, walk around and I'm in here and I'm in close, I'm sort of in my mind, right? Or I'm in my inner life, whatever it is, and then the world is out there. He says, no, you are in the world. You are part of the world. Your inner life is part of the world. If you do something to repair yourself as an individual, you've done something good for yourself, and maybe you've obviously done something good, say, for the people around you, but you've also done something good in the world because the world is fundamentally alive. And the world is not only alive in body, the world is also alive in soul. Right? Sort of that which we use, that's which we try to characterize by these terms like self, by these terms like spirit and soul. These aren't just metaphors. They are real. They are real presences in the world. And the inner work that you do on yourself is something that you're actually doing in the world because you are part of the world. Your ruchness is part of the world, right? So, but this is true for the individual, but this is also true of the collective, right? Down to the details, right? You decide to be like more makbid on a certain mitzvah in the right way. You've done something good for yourself, but you've also done something in the world. And similarly, all the repairs and improvements of culture by which the world rises from its destruction, forms of social and economic life, which are continually improving, along with the repairs and restorations of every sin and trespass, from the most severe to the most fine-tuned and the most far-reaching forms of saintliness, all are one integral unity and are not detached from one another. And he quotes like a paraphrase of the Tzar, and all ascend to one place. So what we call tshuva is a force working, is one way of characterizing the force in the world that wants to become better because things want to return to God, right? God is vibrating in the world, and human forms of idealism and so forth are, so to speak, God's way of calling to us and working through us to make the world better and make ourselves better. And tshuva is then one way of looking at a process, not only in lives of individuals, but also in the life of the world. Before I go forward, at this point, does anyone have any questions or comments you'd like to raise? Anyone? Anything?
You can speak up if anybody would like.
Right. Well, one thing I'll add is if someone, okay, what's another way of describing, what's another word that we use to describe the kind of things that he's talking about, you know, like this process where like the world keeps getting better and better and so forth. Yes, someone. Someone say something in the chat here. Let's see. Okay, let me open the chat. And is tikkun, okay, right. Okay, here we are. Now, okay, as, Mona Fishbane, would you like to say something and then, or write something in the chat before I speak to what things people have been saying here? Because I actually...
Yeah. It's easier to just say it. It's lovely learning with you, first of all. You know, in our
coming
era,
from you, that means a great deal.
Thank you. In our era of so much divisiveness about vision for culture, I'm wondering how whether he addressed that at all about, you know, one person's view of a better culture and a better world.
Right, of course.
Very different from another. So I'd love for you to address that.
Of course. Okay. So it's like this. So as you may have noticed, he's a great believer. I mean, the word I was thinking somebody might use is progress. Right, it's a great believer in progress. Also, you notice this is written before World War I, right? So in many ways, I mean, he's this rabbi and he's this Kabbalist and he's everything. And he's also this like very nice, he's like a very recognizable sort of like 19th century, early 20th century believer in progress and ideals and so forth, right? That's how, for instance, some of you may be familiar with this, you know, he writes about vegetarianism, right? And for him, you know, the vegetarian movement, I mean, he writes about this early on. He himself was not vegetarian. I believe he would eat meat, but only on Shabbat. Some of his close disciples, like the Nazir and others, were vegetarians. Because he's also one of the reasons he's interested in vegetarianism through Leo Tolstoy. Leo Tolstoy is a very important figure in early Zionism, even though Tolstoy himself is by no means a Zionist or by no means a Judeophile, but Tolstoy's return to nature and return to peasantry and all that kind of thing. Tolstoy is this very important figure for all sorts of early Zionists, and Tolstoy becomes a vegetarian. So a lot of Jews are sort of talking about this, and Rav Kook sees, and just a great example, he sees vegetarianism as a wonderful example of human progress, right? But one that you need to be careful with, you know, because, you know, you don't want to become self-righteous about it, and sort of that's one of the, that's, and you know, and sort of everything in its time. Generally, he sees mitzvot, you know, we're familiar with this genre that flourishes in the Middle Ages of Tamei HaMitzvot, right? Trying to understand the reasons and meanings and significances of different mitzvot, often in philosophical terms. And he's very versed in that literature, and he very explicitly says that he wants, especially in his early writings in Eastern Europe, he wants to do some version of that, but he parts company with Maimonides and Saadia, and sort of the great practitioners of this, you know, especially Maimonides, often Maimonides' understandings of Tamei HaMitzvot, especially as presented in Guide for the Perplexed, are very backward looking, right? Why did the Torah say to do korbanot? Because, like, you know, Maimonides, philosopher God, has absolutely no need of korbanot. Maimonides says, well, because ancient peoples did sacrifices, so God said you needed to do this kind of thing, right? Rav Kook's Tamei HaMitzvot are prospective. The ethics of the future will be better than ours, and mitzvot are education for the higher ethics of the future. Right, so that's generally how he looks at these kinds of things. As far as As far as Mona Fishbane's question about differences, oh yes. He writes at length about controversy and difference, and I mean, he's obsessed with it. And what really concerned him were debates among idealists, right? I mean, sort of Rev Cook is not someone who has, he doesn't reckon much with things like, you know, the profit motive, you know, people who just like want people who do things in order to make money. It's not part of his world, for better or worse. Also people who do things for the sake of power, for exercising power over one another. That's not part of his world. Indeed, one issue with his thought is that he really can't imagine Jews abusing power. He generally sees different rival conceptions of the good and of culture as, again, sort of using the capitalistic model of all multifaceted expressions of one greater truth, right, that sort of complement each other, such that, you know, nationalism and universalism, ultimately, you know, each one is sort of taking one element of a larger truth, right? You know, people who emphasize halachic minutiae and people who emphasize the spirit over halachic minutiae, each one has a piece of the truth. For him, part of his, you know, like, we, you know, great religious thinkers are always redefining basic terms. We're walking him through as he redefines the word tshuva. A really important thing that he redefines is kodesh, the sacred. For him, the sacred is the unity of all of these things. The sacred is the energy that ultimately reconciles the nationalist in the messianic future, ultimately reconciles the nationalist and the universalist and the spiritually minded person and the more, halachically detailed minded person, you know, the chassid and the litvak, you know, the Jew and the non-Jew, all that kind of thing. Now, was he influenced by Adam Smith? I've never seen that. I don't think that he himself never writes positively about capitalism. He doesn't, I mean, I haven't seen things where he doesn't denounce capitalism, but it's kind of meaningless to him. And, you know, he writes, he has really interesting things to say. He regards socialism as, you know, a spiritually charged movement. He regards anarchism as a spiritually charged movement. And he sees that anarchism is ultimately more holy than socialism, even though, like, socialism can to some extent be realized in this world, anarchism just can't, right? This was someone I had asked privately in the chat about him and Adam Smith. I mean, he generally doesn't write about economics or economic theory. It tends not to interest him, the same way diplomacy and statecraft tend not to interest him. And he's not unlike Adam Smith. First of all, he may have read in translation. I mean, I think he was somewhat familiar with David Hume. I don't think he's ever read much Adam Smith. I mean, we could also talk about how he and others view capitalism. Also, like, very much viewing capitalism through a moral lens as a kind of, like, moral philosophy in many ways, at least to my mind, doesn't really start getting articulated until the Cold War. I think that's just humorous. Right? Someone's asking about his view on the votes of women's suffrage. We'll get to we'll talk about that later because it's a little off track. I'll be glad to talk about that. The question is, how does Rav Cook balance the almost metaphoric use of the concept of tshuva with the halachic minutiae in Rambam's Hilchot Tshuva, for instance? Well, for him, they complement one another, right? Because you need both, right? You need, he has a very famous essay called Chacham Adif Min Avid, right? There's a line in the Talmud in Bava Batra that says, where the Chazal say Chacham Adif Min Avid. And he says, he asks, why? Why should the sage be better than the prophet? And he says, well, take a look at the historical example of idolatry in ancient Israel, right? Who denounced idolatry with greater passion and force and insight than the biblical prophets, right? Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yehezkel, etc. And yet, like, how good a job did they do of eliminating idolatry? Not very, you know, as we see, the temple was destroyed not once, but twice, right? So, right? The rabbis are less poetic, less dramatic, but they actually tell you how to get things done, right? You know, the Navi will say, you know, the Navi will say, no, ha'omer la'etza vi'ata, right? Sort of like this wonderfully powerful, arresting, rhetorical turn of phrase. But the Chacham will actually write Mishnah, Masechet Avodah Zarah, and say, okay, you don't want to fall into Avodah Zarah, so 3 days before their holidays, don't do this and don't do that. The day before, you can do this, but don't do that. 2 days after their holiday, you can do this and not do that, right? You need, in our world, you need the details. But the details need to reinforce one another, right? Because for Rav Kook, this is also like this. He's eventually his interest in Agadah, he frames in these terms. You need halacha and you need Agadah. You need the careful attention, a jurist's attention to the details of what you do in life and in the, through the law, and you need a broader vision. And you can't have one without the other, because like to have one without the other is like having a body without a soul or a soul without a body. And indeed, Rambam's Hilchot Teshuvah, you can say, is a great example, because the Rambam gives you in Hilchot Teshuvah very detailed instructions about how to undertake tshuva. And then at the end, right in the end of Hilchot Teshuvah, what does the Rambam say? The Rambam says the goal is that you should be deliriously in love with God, the same way a man, the same way lovers are in love with one another, right? And so like Rav Kook maybe would say that like Rambam's Hilchot Teshuvah is like a wonderful illustration of this, of how the details can bring you to a great, to the realization of a great vision. As far as by the way, someone asks, did Rav Kook discuss Spinoza? Oh yes. Rav Kook and his understanding of Spinoza is something to which I've devoted a lot of time. Let me just ask the person who asked, did Rav Kook ever discuss Spinoza? Did you ask, is that because of how he's talking about nature? The person who asked that question in the chat, would you like to, could you elaborate on that or not? Okay. I'll basically say one of the reasons why Rav Kook is, there's early Zionists are obsessed with Spinoza for two reasons. One, because he's the great heretic and they're heretics. Two, because Spinoza in his theological political tract, the Tractatus, reads the Bible as a political book. And that's how the Zionists are reading the Bible as a political book. But there's another side of Spinoza, and that's the side that actually interests Rav Kook, and Spinoza identifies God with nature. And so Rav Kook is intrigued by this idea, but Rav Kook says that, he thinks Spinoza is right up to a point, but stops, right? Because Spinoza identifies God with nature in this very static way, where nature is a closed system and nothing is ever really changing. The best the human birds can do is learn to adjust themselves to it, which takes a lot of work, because for Spinoza, adjusting yourself to nature means undergoing a moral education, means controlling your passion, means cultivating your mind, means learning how to live with other people. It's no small thing. And indeed, by the way, a great example of the censorship of Rav Kook's texts. In his diary, he writes, you know, Spinoza was a heretic, Spinoza was terrible, it was a good thing that he was excommunicated. And in this edition, they stop with that. But in this edition, you get the full passage in Rav Kook where he says, don't get me wrong, there was a lot of good stuff in Spinoza. Spinoza needs to be redeemed. The redemption of Spinoza has already begun. It's begun consciously by Moses Mendelssohn and unconsciously by the Baal Shem Tov. Right, because the Baal Shem Tov is talking about finding God in the natural world. Now, I see there's some very good questions, but I would like to get through at least this one sheet today. Okay. This next sheet, right? And then in the interest of time, I'll read in English. The world must necessarily arrive at perfect tshuva. The world does not stand still. Rather, it goes and develops, and the true perfect development must bring it to perfect health, material and spiritual, and with it bring the light of the life of tshuva. Right? Tshuva is this process and force working through the world, and must happen, right? The spirit of tshuva blows in the world and gives it its chief character and the impetus to its development, and with the scent of its fragrances, it renders it more delicate and gives it the quality of beauty and splendor. Now, fragrance, it's not just a metaphor. In Kabbalistic language, fragrance, Bisum Ha'olam, means the diminution of the harshness of the world. And fragrancing in Kabbalah means sort of a diminution of Midat Hadin and an emergence of Midat Harachamin. Sort of like less judgment, less severity, more loving kindness, more flowing goodness, right? So tshuva, what goes on in the world, people trying to make the world better, is itself part of tshuva, right? And now here also, haratzon haba mikocha shel tshuva haratzon ha'amok shel omik ha'chayim la'aratzon ha'shitchi yishuto ve'zraket ha'tzadim harafim v'chitzonim shel ha'chayim kimoto haratzon shu ha'garin ha'yoter pnimi v'yisod ha'chayim v'rehi ha'tzmiyut ha'gmura shel ha'nshama. The will, which derives from the power of tshuva, is the deep will of the depth of life, not the superficial will, which grasps only the weak and external sides of life, but rather the will, which is the innermost nucleus of the foundation of life, and it is the very selfhood of the soul. Think of the times in your life when you have wanted something so profoundly that your sense was like your very being was wound up in this, and that it was directed towards something good. Often we find this in the realm of relationships, right? Like a will to be a better partner, a better parent, a better friend, a better member of the community. Not just, oh, I ought to do more of that, but a sense of like, no, your sense of who you are and who you want to be as a human being is that. And then finally, this is where he makes it very clear. Tshuva derives from the aspiration of all existence to be more good, refined, stronger, and better than it is. Hidden in this desire is a life force that would overcome the limited dimensions of being and its weaknesses. And the particular tshuva of an individual, and all the more so the community, draws its strength from this fount of life, which continually exercises its strength in never-ending action. Now, Rav Kook, speaking to the comments that Mishum Gottlieb has made, Rav Kook is a great believer in being medaktik in halacha and mitzvot and in following the prescriptions of the Rambam ben Hilchot Tshuva and doing vidui and doing charata, and he was took like great, you know, ascetic practices upon himself. But for him, the point of this is not to diminish your life force, but it's to sort of clear your mind and your heart and your spirits so that you can focus on bringing out the best in your life and bringing this to the surface, right? And this is both true for individuals and for the Jewish people. The national renaissance, Chiyat Ha'umah. Okay, so here this is also where he's relating this to Zionism. The national renaissance, Zionism, not just as like a political and social movement, but as a cultural and spiritual movement. The national renaissance is the foundation of the great edifice of Tshuva, the higher Tshuva of Israel and the entire world that will follow in its train, right? Because remember, for Rav Kook, the redemption of the Jewish people is the redemption of the world. Israel is there to redeem the world. Rav Kook is actually very alive to the moral problems of nationalism, right? And especially in his earlier writings, he's very explicit of this. He says, you know, Jewish le'umiyut is not nationalismus. Le'umiyut is not nationalism, because nationalism is chauvinism. Le'umiyut is about wanting to make the world better. It's about wanting to make the world more godly, right? That's what the Jews should be wanting to do in Eretz Israel, and that's at its best. That's what tshuva is. So you see, he's re-envisioning tshuva as this cosmic process that courses through society, through culture, and through individuals, alongside the details of Torah and mitzvot. Torah and mitzvot, he's not saying don't do Torah and mitzvot. He's saying think about this is what Torah and mitzvot are trying to do. Right, we'll see in a passage that we'll look at next week, right? For Rav Kook, what's sin? Sinfulness is an opacity that stops up the light. Right? What is sin? Sin is imagine there's a window and there's great light streaming through the window and somebody pulls down the shutter. That's what sinfulness is. The light is there to be found and to be walked in its light. Right? So like the process of tshuva, including halakhic minutiae and so forth, are sort of trying to clean out the detritus of the soul so you see these points of contact here with Mussar, because there's no magic formula for this, right? only you, the individual, can figure out what is it that your soul really needs and is trying to do, and how will your soul actualize itself better. Right? But the answer is not to denigrate yourself. I'm terrible, I'm awful. Right? Tshuvah is not a lonely battle with the Yetzer Hara. Tshuvah is an affirmation of the fundamental goodness of the world and the fundamental goodness in yourself. And it's a goodness that can break through the encrustations of sin, of despair, of bad habits, of vices, which are things that are keeping us from being, as far as he's concerned, who we most truly are. I think we're just at time. Are there any last, some of you who had some questions, especially about some of his later political views, et cetera, you can save them for next week. I'll be glad to go into them, you know, other than to say, one person asked, why was Rifkuk an opponent of women's suffrage? Also remember this is 1920. Women's suffrage is kind of a novelty in Western democracies as well. But for our purposes here, what it shows you, and part of what's so interesting and riveting about him as a thinker, is that on one hand, these are like very far-reaching ideas, very radical ideas. At the same time, in many ways, he's a very conservative man. Right? He's a very traditional Posek. You know, people think that like as a Posek, Rifkuk must have been Makiel all the time on this and that, and he wasn't. Right? It shows you the complexity of the man, and also not infrequently. Sometimes his chumrot, you sometimes see with other Jewish thinkers, especially with Kabbalists, precisely because they have these very radical theological ideas, they tend to be like even more conservative as halachists in terms of maintaining the structure of the system. So we have this very dynamic picture of this man. Somebody says, you said he was into progress, but it seems only when it suited him. I'm not his spokesman here. But I guess, like all of us, one man's progress is another man's regression, right? How we see progress depends. I call it progress because I think it's something good. You call it backsliding because you think it's something bad. I think that's kind of inevitable for people who are making evaluative statements. And also remember that he is very, this is somebody who's like a great believer in people disagreeing, right? One last question about suffrage. I heard that he was against suffrage because he thought women should vote their conscience, but wouldn't if they disagreed with their husbands and Shalom Bayit. Yes, if you look in his writings on women's suffrage, he doesn't make halachic arguments. He tends to make these sort of broad cultural, social policy arguments. Part of it is an innate conservatism. Part of it is a sense of the Jewish family needs to look like what it should look like, the way it's always looked. Part of it is his sense of the Jewish people are now, remember this is 1920, his understanding was that, much of British support for the Jewish national home was based on seeing the Jews as the people of the Bible, and the people of the Bible, women shouldn't vote. It's a number of things coming together. It's not something he wrote about much through the course of his career. In general, we could talk, this is a subject, larger conversation on women's, what we call today women's issues in general. Rifkuk was not a feminist by any stretch of the imagination, right? The issues that exercised and the kinds of halachic change that he envisioned tended not to be in the direction of women's issues. Unlike most Kabbalists, Kabbalah, it's a fascinating system. So you can tell I spent a lot of time studying it. Its attitudes, on the one hand, the feminine dimensions of being in existence are very present there, Kabbalah, but not in complementary ways all the time. So there's elements in Kabbalah that can be extremely misogynistic. In Rifkuk, you never find misogyny. Also, you don't find hatred of non-Jews. He's obsessed with the relationship between Jews and non-Jews, but you never find hatred or demonization of women or of non-Jews. And interestingly, he has these what today we call highly essentialized views of gender. Men are about intellect and women are about feeling, which is highly essentializing. Then you realize in his thought world, feeling is often more important than the intellect, right? Feeling is more of a gateway to prophecy than the intellect is, which means that he himself was not a feminist, but there are people, Professor Tamar Ross is one, others, who, you know, his ideas can be used as ways of thinking about, you know, feminist theology. He himself was not a feminist at all. And yes, the Mizrahi, the religious Zionist faction within the Zionist movement, was in favor of women's suffrage, very in favor of women's suffrage, and this caused a real rift. I mean, Rav Kook was not part of the Mizrahi. It's very, very important to understand. Rav Kook never joined the Mizrahi. He never joined the Zionist movement. He was always very distant from, or he was very askance to and regularly critical of the Mizrahi, because he saw them as, you know, the Mizrahi, as far as they were concerned, they actually wanted to get something done. And if they needed to sort of like take their place as junior partners in the Zionist movement, that's what they were going to do. And that did not resonate with him at all. On the one hand, so like he kept this kind of like spiritual vigor and everything in his views, but it also meant that he was not able to be very effective within the Zionist movement because he wasn't formally part of it and wasn't part of any party. Okay, and one last comment, which is finally, which gets us very nice way of ending the subject band for today. If I understand, Tikkun Olam is a cosmic community tshuva, in many ways, yes. In many ways, yes. He's taking this idea of Tikkun Olam, right? As we know, you know, this idea of Tikkun Olam that's like very bandied about, and especially in American Jewish life, as, you know, a kind of social justice and so on and so forth, is a pretty new invention, right? Not a new invention. I mean, the term Tikkun Olam has, of course, been around for many, many centuries, but using it in this way is a fairly recent coinage. Though Rav Kook is somebody who does use this phrase Tikkun and Tikkun Olam to refer to very concrete social, economic, ethically directed social economic movements. That's a key feature of him, and he does see this as a kind of, as part of tshuva, as this cosmic force that makes the world better, both in the life of individuals and life of society in the world. So I've gone over time enough, Rabbi Kelman.
That's fine.
I'm very gracious about it.
Okay, we look forward to continuing next week. Listen, it's not possible to cover anything about Rav Kook in three lectures, but
that's absolutely true.
To scratch the surface, I think it's wonderful, and thank you very much. We look forward to
my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you all.
Week.
Thank you very much.
I want to wish you a
Kibbutz Chatimah
Tova.
Yes,
everybody, and of course, tomorrow we.
Yirtzeh Hashem, see you all next year.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, things will improve in Israel, especially with the lockdown. You know, the foreign stuff.
Well, the lockdown. Certainly, we've been. Yes, I know. Today we were at the Shuk, and you know, buying up board games and other things.
All right. So
for the long duration, along with the months.
We should all be.
Thank you all very, very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And as we said, tomorrow 11 a.m. Alex Israel on Can We Change, his series on Elul, and I'll be speaking at 8:30 on Shofar and Shabbat. The Sounds of Silence. Everybody's welcome. We look forward to seeing you this week, next week, and everybody should be well, be healthy, and Shana Tova to all. Okay. Have a good